Okay, Erev Tov, I think we can get started. Welcome. It's a pleasure to welcome back Dr. Sokolow, who really needs no introduction. I don't know how many classes you've taught already for Torah Moshe, but it's many, you know, Baruch Hashem, and nice to have
you. Is there a Guinness record for it?
I'm sorry?
Is there a Guinness record I should be shooting
for?
No,
you're not. No, no. You haven't taught that often. You're still, you got a while to go. To get the Guinness Book of the
record. As I said, I leave no stones unturned.
No, you're going to have to teach much more if you want to get to close to the record. But
okay.
we can worry about that later. But anyway, Dr. Sokolow, I said, been teaching at Yeshiva University for 45 years or so. Am I correct in that?
Wow.
At least that many.
At least 45 years. And been teaching, I think, also on the West Side for many years at Lincoln Square, and a prolific author and a clear and organized, you know, teacher. And it's really a pleasure to welcome him. I actually asked him normally for the Parsha, you know, people kind of choose what Parsha they want to go in the list. But Dr. Sokolow wrote you'll hear a very nice article on the Akedah. So I asked him if he would give the Parsha this week on the Akedat Yitzchak, which he will do as right now. So, Vakasha, Dr. Sokolow, welcome back. And we've had too many Akedot, but we should hear good news, and we look forward to your shiur. Okay, I'm glad you're starting with some comics. Always good. Mile de bidichuta. Okay, Vakasha.
Okay. So, cartoons are, if they're drawn well, are usually excellent because occasionally, even without the captions, they can tell a long and complicated story in a relatively brief space. So the subject that I want to talk about this evening is encapsulated in this cartoon. As you see in the cartoon, right, the figure on the left is Abraham. The figure on the right is Isaac. Isaac says to his father Abraham, "Here's the wood for the sacrifice, ha'etzim." His father is pleased, groovy. I don't know really whether that's something that Avraham would have said, but in any event. Okay. Then in the second box, Isaac continues, and he says, "Here's the dagger for the sacrifice, the ma'achelet." And his father says, "Keen," which may very well be a double entendre referring to a knife. I'm sure Abraham was certainly capable of that. And then, as you see in the third box, right, he's testing the blade, okay, to see if in fact it is keen. Then, on the bottom, okay, Isaac asks his father, "Where is the sacrifice?" Hinei ha'esh v'ha'etzim v'ayeh ha'seh le'olah. And Abraham says, "God will provide, Isaac. Elohim yir'elo ha'seh le'olah b'ni." Isaac asks him a question. He says, "Wait a second. Did you say God will provide, comma, Isaac? Or God will provide Isaac?" Abraham then in the last box invites his son to join him, and the son says, "I ain't budging till you put in a comma." Right? And you see the note on the bottom. The cartoon is brought to you by Rashi on Genesis 22:8. Okay? Just to show you quickly what that is referring to. Well, it was here a moment ago. It ain't now. You'll take my word for it. Let's come back. Okay. On Elohim Yir Elo Hasel Ola Bini, Rashi offers us two different interpretations of it. One is, as you see in the box itself, I seem to be having a problem here. Do you still see the cartoon?
Yes.
Oh, that's funny, because I don't.
Oh, we see it.
Yeah, I know. That's helpful for you, but not particularly helpful for me. Okay. So, the two interpretations that Rashi offer us, one of them is Elohim Yirelo Hasel Ola Bini. That is, that the Bain is the Sel Ola. The other one reads the Pasuk as though it said Bini Elohim Yirelo Hasel Ola. That is, my son, God will choose or has chosen the sacrificial animal. Okay. So basically the function of this cartoon is to draw our attention to the fact that we have biblical verses that can be read in more than one way. Now, this is critical to the subject that I want to discuss with you this evening, that I have entitled, What Was Abraham Thinking? Now, the curious thing, not only about the story of the Akedah, but about just almost all biblical stories, is that very rarely does the Torah, or the Tanakh for that matter, actually share with us people's thoughts. On rare occasion, it'll say something like, Vayomer ex el libo. Right? Obviously, when you speak to your heart, it's essentially telling us what your thoughts are. Okay? But that's rather unusual in biblical narratives. Usually, biblical narratives have people act, they have people speak, and it's left to us to deduce from their actions and from their words what their intentions were. The book that I'm holding up, the title of the book is Mimesis. M-I-M-E-S-I-S, like into mimic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And the subtitle of the book is Representations of Reality in Western Literature. Representations of reality, namely, how does Western literature, how do authors in Western literature depict life as it really is. Okay? It's a rather remarkable book. It was written in the late 1930s by a German Jewish refugee named Erich Auerbach, who had been a professor of Romance languages at the University of Marburg in Germany. Parenthetically, for those of you who like to know these things and who wonder whether one day they may actually be the answers on Final Jeopardy, Nechama Leibovitz got her doctorate from the University of Marburg in Germany in the 1930s. She probably had a personal acquaintance with Erich Auerbach. I do know for a fact that this book was on her bookshelf. In 1936, he was fired from his position at the university, and he fled Germany, and he spent the duration of World War II in Turkey, in Istanbul, where he became a professor of literature. And while he was there at the University of Istanbul, without access really to all of the works of literature that are described and analyzed in this book, he wrote this rather remarkable book. Most remarkable of all, from my perspective, is the very opening chapter in the book. The very opening chapter in the book is entitled Odysseus's Scar. Odysseus, right, a hero of the Homeric epics, right, had a scar, and when he returned home after his odyssey, right, his identity was discovered because somebody recognized the scar. Okay? But the most important part of this is that it serves Erich Auerbach as an opportunity to compare Homeric literature with the Bible. And I just want to read you a couple of brief excerpts from this chapter in order to give us a foundation, a platform on which to build this evening's class. The genius of the Homeric style becomes even more apparent when it is compared with an equally ancient and equally epic style from a different world of forms. I shall attempt this comparison with the account of the sacrifice of Isaac. The King James Version translates the opening as follows. And it came to pass after these things that God did tempt Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, Behold, here I am. Even this opening startles us when we come to it from Homer. Where are the two speakers? We aren't told. The reader, however, knows that they are not normally to be found together in one place on earth, that one of them, God, in order to speak to the other, Abraham, must come from somewhere, must enter the earthly realm from some unknown heights or depths. Whence does he come? Whence does he call to Abraham? We're not told. He does not come like Zeus or Poseidon from the Ethiopians, where he has been enjoying a sacrificial feast. Nor are we told anything of his reasons for tempting Abraham so terribly. He has not, like Zeus, discussed them in set speeches with other gods gathered in council, nor have the deliberations in his own heart been presented to us. Unexpected and mysterious, he enters the scene from some unknown height or depth and calls Abraham. Basically, the theme of this chapter is to compare and contrast the richness of detail, even physical details, of characters and plots in Homeric literature with the relative dearth, absence of such details in biblical narratives. We find the same contrast if we compare the two uses of direct discourse. The personages speak in the Bible story too, but their speech does not serve, as does speech in Homer, to manifest, to externalize thoughts. On the contrary, it serves to indicate thoughts which remain unexpressed. God gives his command in direct discourse, but he leaves his motives and his purpose unexpressed. Abraham, receiving the command, says nothing and does what he has been told to do. The conversation between Abraham and Isaac on the way to the place of sacrifice is only an interpretation of the heavy silence and makes it all the more burdensome. The two of them, Isaac carrying the wood and Abraham with fire and a knife, went together, vayalchu shnehem yachdav. Hesitantly, Isaac ventures to ask about the ram. That's our cartoon. And Abraham gives the well-known answer. Then the text repeats, vayalchu shnehem yachdav. They both went together. Everything remains unexpressed. It would be difficult then to imagine styles more contrasted than those of these two equally ancient and equally epic texts. Basically, without prolonging this, as I said, the richness of detail, right? Physical descriptions of characters. How many biblical characters are we given their physical descriptions? Yes, occasionally one is called a Yafei Toar or a Yafat Toar, or somebody is described as Ish Chalak and his brother, by contrast, as an Ish Sa'ir. But were they tall? Were they short? Were they rotund? Were they skinny? Right? We're given no such descriptions, as opposed to the richness of such descriptions in Homeric literature. The point that I want to make, as I said, in order to give us a platform for this evening, is that clearly by withholding that information from us, by not sharing with us not only what people looked like, but what people were actually thinking, but sharing with us only their words when they needed to communicate with each other and their actions, the Torah basically is leaving it to us to infer what their intentions were. So when I raise the question, what was Abraham thinking? I'm basically saying to myself, we have a character, Abraham, who was given a particular instruction by God, and he goes together with his son Isaac and with two of his servants, ostensibly to fulfill that instruction. Somewhere along the way, there's a crisis. And the instruction, as he understood it initially, was not carried out. Rather, something else happens. 3 days from the time that Abraham received the instruction until he and Isaac arrived at the Eretz Amoriah. What was in Abraham's mind throughout those 3 days? If you had been able to interview him along the way as he stopped for the night, right? What would he have said in response to the question, Abraham, what are you planning to do? Abraham, what are you thinking? Now, there's a traditional answer to this. And the traditional conventional answer is that God instructed Abraham to take his son Isaac to the top of a mountain in Moriah land and there to offer his son Isaac as a sacrifice, an olah sacrifice to God. So that if in fact Abraham and Isaac didn't converse during the 3 days, it's likely because, given that situation, what is there to say? Abraham wasn't going to fail in his mission to fulfill God's instruction, and Isaac knew better than to presume that he could change his father's mind. That's the conventional story. And I must tell you in all honesty, and perhaps you'll agree with me, I never liked that. It wasn't just the question of, does God want child sacrifice? Because the answer to that clearly is no, he doesn't. And the bottom line of the story is that there is no child sacrifice. So there are no grounds on which to charge, as it were, God with the crime of child sacrifice. But on the other hand, what did he put into Abraham's mind? What was Abraham carrying with him for 3 days? Is it just right for God to plant the seed in Abraham's mind that in 3 days he will take his son's life? Remember for a moment, just the chapter ago, Abraham was asked by his wife Sarah to expel his concubine Hagar and her son Ishmael, and essentially to cast them out into the wilderness, which, as the Torah actually affirms for us, was tantamount to giving them a death sentence. He gave them a small amount of water and sent them out into the desert. How does the Torah describe Abraham's reaction to this? The Torah says, Vayera Avraham Ma'od, that this request on the part of Sarah, it grieved him tremendously. So much so that God had to come and tell him, Kol asher tomar elecha Sarah shma bekola, right? God had to come along and reassure him that it was okay to do, right? And mind you, as I said, he wasn't actively going to take a life. He was simply asked to put them into what might very well or likely had been mortal jeopardy. So learn a kal vachomer. If when asked by Sarah to place the lives of Hagar and Ishmael in a possible mortal jeopardy, the Torah tells us how it grieved Avraham. Why doesn't the Torah tell us that when God instructed him to sacrifice his son Isaac, to actively take his life, shouldn't it have said, Vayera la Avraham ma'od ma'od ma'od? And yet, ostensibly, Abraham doesn't seem to be troubled at all. And he seems to go blithely on his way. Here you see on the end of the first page, it's an actual transcript of a portion of a class, of a day school class, a high school class that was discussing the 22nd chapter of the book of Bereshit, the story of Akedat Yitzchak, where the teacher asked the students, the Akedah is a complicated and difficult issue. What's difficult about the Akedah? What is problematic about it? One student says, losing your son. Teacher says, no, it's stronger than that. Another student says, killing your son. Teacher then wants to get something more conceptual out and says, so this is the problem of? And a third student adds, we don't murder. The whole thing of Hashem is like there were people who were sacrificing their babies. The whole point is that he was a good God. So again, yes, in the final analysis, Isaac is not sacrificed. Abraham does not commit a child sacrifice, and God does not have a child sacrifice to him. But still, according to conventional interpretation, that seems to be what God intended Abraham to believe in the first place, and that indeed would have been what Abraham was thinking of for the 3 days that they traveled. Indeed, the Torah tells us very clearly, Lo yimatzei v'cha ma'avir b'no uvito ba'esh, let no one among you consign a son or a daughter to the fire. So, doesn't God keep the Torah? And if in the Torah it is a explicit prohibition to offer a child sacrifice, how could God ever have intended that for Abraham and Isaac? More interestingly, however, are three psukim in the book of Yirmiyahu that also relate to the subject of child sacrifice, as it was even in the time of Yirmiyahu, in the 6th century before the Common Era. It was clearly still a widespread practice amongst other nations in the Middle East. And I would say from archaeological evidence, also across North Africa. The first verse in chapter 7. Uvanu bamot hatofet asher begei behinom. They have built bamot, right, altars, in a valley called Hinom, Gei ben Hinom, which of course is the where we derive the word Gehenom from. Okay, and the purpose of these altars is lisrof et bnehem ve'et benotehem ba'esh, to consign their sons and daughters to the flames. And what does God say about that? Asher lo tziviti, this is something that I never commanded anyone to do. V'lo alta alibi, not only is it something that I never commanded anybody to do, how could you ever imagine that this is something I would have thought of? Now, wait a second. Didn't you tell Abraham to do that? And look in the next verse. The same thing, referring to the child sacrifice. Asher lo tziviti, I never ordered anybody to do this. Lo dibarti, I never even talked to anybody about it. And again, lo alta libi, it never entered my mind. And similarly in the third verse, again, asher lo tzivitim v'lo alta libi, I never gave such instructions and it never entered my mind. So what do we believe? Do we believe the voice of God, as is expressed through the prophet Yirmiyahu and through the explicit verse in Sefer Devarim that says, absolutely not, don't even think about child sacrifice? Or do we believe the conventional standard interpretation that that in fact is what God ordered Abraham to do? Now, I'm not the first person who thought of this, okay? We have already in the Midrash Tanchuma, a venerable Midrash from the Tannaitic age. Kach shanu rabotenu, the rabbis learned as follows. Citing the verse in Yirmiyahu, again the verse that says, Asher lo tziviti v'lo dibarti v'lo alta libi. I never told anybody, never instructed anybody to offer a child sacrifice. I never even discussed the subject with anybody, and it certainly never even entered my mind. It takes each segment of this verse and applies it to a biblical instance of real or ostensible child sacrifice, saying as follows: Lo tziviti, whom did I not instruct to offer a child sacrifice? Li yiftach sheyakrivit bito. Again, that's not the only, but it is a widespread understanding of the story of Yiftach's daughter, right, who came out to greet him when he returned successfully from his battle against the Ammonites, and he had made a rash oath that the first thing that comes out of his home to greet him will belong to God. So if in fact you think that that he took his daughter's life in order to honor his oath, the Midrash says that's not something God approves of. Lo dibarti, to whom did God not even raise the subject of child sacrifice? Mesha melech Moab sheyakrivet beno. That's an episode that's narrated at the beginning of the second book of Kings. And the book of Kings actually tells us that when the king of Moab, in order to gain the favor of his God, sacrificed one of his children in public, the reaction amongst the Jewish people was that they simply withdrew from battle. They were so disgusted over it that they simply withdrew from battle. So this too, the Midrash wants to tell us, is not something that God finds pleasing. And finally, to what is God referring when he says that the idea of child sacrifice never even entered his mind? Lo alta alibi lomar la Avraham sheyishchot et bino. And this isn't only in the Midrash, as you can see in the source below it. It's also very clearly in the Gemara itself, in Masechet Ta'anit. The last sentence, Lo alta alibi ze Yitzchak ben Avraham. So what we seem to have here is what we call a stira, a contradiction, right? On the one hand, we have the traditional, conventional understanding of Akedat Yitzchak, that God indeed instructed Abraham to take his son's life. And yet we seem to have ample biblical, or at least midrashic and Talmudic interpretations of biblical evidence to the contrary. And again, I didn't discover this contradiction. It's already there in the commentary, the Torah commentary of Don Yitzchak Abravanel. If you're not acquainted with Abravanel's style, at the beginning of every new chapter or every new episode, the Bible, he starts off with an overview in which he poses certain general questions, and then in the course of his commentary, he answers those questions. The sixth question that he addresses to the story of the Akedah is as follows. If God clearly commanded Abraham to take your son and raise him up there as an offering, as an olah, how could the sages in Masechet Ta'anit, that's the last source we looked at, have presumed to offer a homily that lo alta alibi, it never crossed my mind, referring to Isaac, the son of Abraham? So his answer is as follows. The homily that they offered Masechet Ta'anit, namely that it never crossed my mind, refers to Isaac, the son of Abraham, informs us that it was not God's intention that Isaac be slaughtered, and that the Holy One regretted it afterwards. Well, if it wasn't his intention, what did he regret? We'll get there. Okay? And that he regretted it afterwards and instructed Abraham not to slaughter him. Why? Highlighted passage, because from the outset, God did not intend Isaac's slaughter. So if that's not what he intended, what was his intention? Look at the next highlighted passage. The divine intention was not for Isaac to die, but rather for Isaac to reach let's just read his words. To reach the gates of death, sha'arei mavet. That is, he should be regarded as though he were dead and nullified from this world. That's the best that Abravanel can make of the story. And if you have an opportunity over the weekend in Shul, maybe on Shabbat, to look at the Art Scroll commentary, you'll see that essentially they adopt the position of Abravanel. They're also worried or disturbed by the ostensible meaning of Ha'alehu Sham La'ola, to offer him as a sacrifice. And therefore, they basically say, no, that wasn't God's intention. His intention was that Abraham should show his willingness to slaughter Isaac, but not actually take his life. Okay? Now, that did not satisfy me. Because once again, it means that during those 3 days on their journey to Har HaMoriah, again, if you had stopped Abraham and asked him, Abraham, where are you going and what are you intent on doing? Abraham would have said, even according to Abravanel, right? I'm on my way with my son Isaac to Har HaMoriah to offer him as an olah sacrifice. And even if it turns out that that's not what God intended literally, it's still quite a burden to place on Abraham for those 3 days. And if it didn't distress Abraham, it bothered the heck out of me. So I kept on looking, and I found an alternative. And here we have the commentary of the 14th century Provençal exegete, the Ralbag, Rabbi Levi ben Gershon. And look what he says. Elohim nisa et Abraham. We will in a few minutes have a look at some of the English translations of the word nisa, just to see how complicated its translation could be. But he tells us that nisa hu me'inyan nisayon, right, that the word nisa is related philologically to the word nisayon that means a test. Ve'inyan zeh nisayon haya, what was the subject of this test? Lefi da'ati. Now you gotta know, of course, when he says lefi da'ati, he knows that he's swimming upstream. Right? He knows that he's going in a direction other than the one that is conventional. And that's why he tells you at the outset that this is his understanding. Watch. Sheba'atu hanivu'ah, that this prophecy came to Abraham. What prophecy? When God speaks to a prophet, it's prophetic. Okay? Sheba'atu hanivu'ah bilashon misupak. Ralbag says that the critical to understanding this story is to appreciate that the words that God used in instructing Abraham were deliberately ambiguous. Vehu, namely, shekvar amar lo Hashem yitale al Yitzchak, since God had already told Abraham in regards to Isaac, va'aleihu sham la'ola, that's the critical passage, that's the ambiguous passage, right? V'zeh ha'ma'amar yitachen, he says this phrase can be understood in two different ways. One possible way is, sheyizbach oto v'ya'asem mimenu ola. That's one way in which we understand those three words. He becomes the sacrifice. Again, referring back to the cartoon, okay? That's the one without the comma. Oh, however, he says, those same three words can be understood differently. And the different understanding is, sheya'alehu sham la'asot ola, that Isaac should accompany him to the top of the mountain, where together they would offer a sacrifice. And what's the purpose of bringing Isaac along? Kedei sheyitchanech Yitzchak ba'avodat Hashem yit'aleh. As part of Isaac's religious training. Isaac, according to Ralbag, was apparently of an age now where he needed to be taught what an adult Jew needs to know in order to serve God. Now, I should just add parenthetically that, of course, this too swims against the current of the traditional understanding. The traditional understanding of the story has Isaac as 37 years old at the time of the Akedah. Okay. Not only is that difficult to maintain in the face of the references to him in the story as a na'ar, which usually means a teenager, but it's also rather difficult to understand. Abraham at that point then would be 137 years old himself. So you have a 137-year-old father who is tying up a 37-year-old man and raising him up to place him on top of the wood on top of an altar. Not impossible, but certainly stretching credulity. The alternative, Ralbag seems to suggest, is that Isaac indeed was a na'ar. He was a teenager. He was, very well, 13 years old at this time. And as a 13-year-old about to make the step into adulthood, right, part of his education was, how do we offer sacrifices? Therefore, again, says Ralbag, sheya'alehu sham la'asot ola, that Isaac should accompany Abraham to the top of the mountain in order together to perform a sacrifice, kidei sheyitchanech Yitzchak ba'avodat Hashem yit'aleh, so that he should be properly educated in the service of God. And now if we come back to that ambiguous verse, the one that with or without the comma, right, means two very different things. When Isaac said to Abraham, Hine ha'esh v'ha'etzim v'aye ha'seh la'ola, Abraham says to him, Elohim yirelo ha'seh la'ola b'ni, meaning, I brought along an esh, and I brought along etzim, should add parenthetically. What does Abraham also have that Isaac fails to mention? He has a ma'achelet, right? He has a butcher's knife. It's, again, entirely age-appropriate for a 13-year-old to ignore the butcher's knife simply because it's frightening. So when Isaac says, we've brought along all of the fixings for a sacrifice, except for the guest of honor, so to speak, Abraham answers him by saying, my understanding of my instructions were to bring along the necessary equipment for a sacrifice, but that Elohim yir elo haseh, I was not instructed to bring along the sacrificial animal, because my understanding of my instructions was that that would be provided by God himself. And indeed, the end of the story is, Vayisa Avraham et Enav, that Abraham looked about, Vayar, and what did he see? There was an aisle. Achar ne'echaz basvach bekarnav. The aisle, the ram, was caught in the thicket by his horns. So why didn't Abraham see him in the first place? Because he was achar. He was on the far side of the thicket of the Savach. But once Abraham understood that there had to be a sacrificial animal waiting for him, because that indeed is what God had instructed, he did a more thorough investigation. He discovered the aisle. Vayelech Avraham vayikach et ha'ayle vayaleh le'ola tachad b'no. And there's support for this notion, outlandish as it may seem, from a Mishnah in Avot. The Mishnah in Avot talks about 10 things that were created on a primordial Friday in the twilight between Friday and Shabbat. Okay? And 10 things are enumerated. But then there is a second opinion, towards the end of the second line, V'yesh Omrim. There are those who say that there weren't just 10 things, but there were other things that were created on this primordial Friday in the twilight before Shabbat. And that included the highlighted passage, Elo shel Avraham Avinu, the ram that Abraham used in lieu of Isaac. The ram did not have to be there for 2,000 years. In fact, it would have been probably remarkable if it had been there for 2,000 years, not only because rams generally don't live that long, but because between the primordial Friday and the Akedah, there was also a flood. It's a question whether the flood was in the land of Israel or not in the land of Israel, but if it had been in the land of Israel, then the ram certainly would have had to hold its breath for a rather long time. I understand this Mishnah not to require me to think that the ram that Abraham offered in lieu of Isaac was 2,000 years old. I think all it's really telling me is that it was there already. That when Abraham arrived there and Isaac said, Aye Hasela Ola, if Abraham had just simply done a more thorough search, he would have found the aisle. They would have offered it up as an Ola. He would have accomplished his task to educate Isaac in the proper service of God. They would have returned home, and I don't even know whether the story would have been in the Torah. The problem, of course, was that when Abraham did not spy the aisle in his first survey, he began to question his instructions. God had said to him, Kach et bincha. You remember what the Medrash says that Abraham answered God? He said, hey God, I got two banim. So God continued and said, Yechidcha, the one who's an only child to his mother. What did Abraham say? Ooh, God, each of them is an only child to his mother. So God moves on and says, no, the one you love. And Abraham says, God, I love them both. So finally God gives up and he says, Yitzchak. Okay. So Abraham looks around. He says, God told me to take Yitzchak. This is Yitzchak. That's okay. Okay. Then God said, V'lech lecha el eretz ha-Moriah. So Abraham looks around. I don't know. Maybe there was a big, sign there, a roadside sign saying, welcome to Eretz HaMoriah. He knew he was in the right place. Okay? And then it says, Valeu Sham La'ola. So Abraham began to question. He said, for 3 days, I thought that what God had told me to do is to equip ourselves for a Korban Ola and that he would provide one. But now that I'm here and I don't see what provision God has made for the Korban Olah, maybe I misunderstood my instructions. And as Rabbah told us, the only other interpretation that you could give to the words Va'aleu Sham La'olah is to assume that God intended Isaac to be the sacrificial victim. And that's why Abraham binds Isaac and places him on the wood above the altar. Whereupon God immediately dispatches an angel to say, Abraham, time out. This is not what you were instructed to do. But the curious thing is that God says to Abraham, Ata yadati ki yirei Elohim ata. Now I know how God-fearing you are. Excuse me, God, a moment ago you didn't know. You really needed this test in order to determine that? Does God not know everything in advance? So here's the curious thing. Let's look again at the, Okay. Here's the commentary of Ibn Ezra on the beginning of the story. Ibn Ezra tells us as follows, Vayomer HaGaon, he cites the Torah commentary, and it's also the Arabic Torah translation of Sa'adya Gaon. What did Sa'adya Gaon say? Shemilat Nisa, that when it says that God Nisa et Avraham, its meaning is not restricted to testing, with the word test to be defined as determining something unknown previously. Rather, it can be understood as leharot tzidkato livnei adam. That is, that God knew that Abraham was a Yirei Elohim, but God was using the instance of the Akedah to make Abraham's Yirat Elohim a matter of public record. Similarly, says Sa'adia, when God says, Ata yada'ati ki Yirei Elohim ata, it's not to be understood, now I know, as opposed to previously that I didn't know. Rather, it means, hoda'ati, right? That I have made this something that I already knew public. I have made it known to others. Now, here's an interesting thing. If we go back here to some of the English translations of V'ha'elohim nisa'i et Avraham, okay? Notice, in the old English translations, including the King James, it's translated as tempt. We use the word temptation a little differently nowadays than we use the word test, but in medieval English, in old and medieval English, they were synonymous, okay? The proof, of course, is that in just about every other translation, it's clearly tested, okay? The current JPS translation put Abraham to the test. Everett Fox tested Abraham. Art Scroll tested Abraham. Alter tested Abraham. Look at the one that's different. The original 1917 Jewish Publication Society translation. And it came to pass after these things that God did prove Abraham. It's a curious thing about the word prove in English. The verb prove and the noun proof in English have two meanings. They can be used either to describe the process, but they can also be used to describe the result of the process. Think, if you wish, of where does the army go to test weapons? It goes to a proving ground. Remember the old saw? It's the exception that proves the rule. Think about it logically. Exceptions don't prove rules in the sense of demonstrating that they're true. It's quite the opposite. Exceptions challenge rules. That's the old meaning of the word prove. It means to test. The exception that proves the rule is an exception that tests the rule. Same thing applies, havdil, to the alcoholic content of certain beverages, okay, which is called the proof.
Yes.
So when the Jewish Publication Society translated V'ha'elohim nisa' et Avraham as God did prove Abraham, they were basically using the approach that Ibn Ezra credits to Sa'adya Gaon. They were saying that it isn't necessary for God to test somebody in order to determine something, to learn something that he didn't know previously, because God is omniscient. But God may occasionally create some sort of a situation in which something that was known to God alone now becomes known to other people as well. In which case, it's not lit, okay. It's not strictly a test, it's also a proof.
Okay, Heidi.
And to go back to where we started, to... Okay.
That was me. I'm going to make you co-host. That was me, so I could mute the noise in the background, which I couldn't do while you were the host. So I apologize. And now you can go and share your screen again.
Okay.
Sorry about
that. To finish with the same, what we began. And as I said, with the transcript of that high school Chumash class, the teacher, having introduced the students to Sa'adya Gaon's understanding of Nisa as to prove, and Ataya Da'ati as Hoda'ati, to make known to others, asked the students to put it into their own words. And the first student said, So we learned that Avraham could be a higher authority. Another student said, well, the word nes in Hebrew means a flag. Okay? What is a flag? A flag is a symbol. Just as a flag symbolizes something important, so is Abraham, as it were, raised as a flag to symbolize something important. Okay? Teacher, again, to direct the conversation, said he was put at higher heights. And the students add, let's talk about his greatness, the flag, like it's a whole different idea. And just so that you should not think that this is just something that I invented based on cherry picking from Saadia Gaon and Ralbag, I found the same thing in a more mainstream text. Believe it or not, it's in some, though not all, editions of Rashi's commentary on this parasha. Here, on verse 12, Ki ata yadati, now I know that you are a Yirei Elohim, Rashi cites what is essentially the text of a Midrash in Bereshit Rabbah. And he says, Amar lo Avraham, Abraham said as follows to God, Efros lefanecha et sichati, allow me, as it were, to, so you can see what I'm up to, allow me to talk this out with you. Et mol, in the past, Amartali, you told me, ki b'Yitzchaki karei lecha zara, you told me that my line will continue, my dynasty, as it were, will continue through Isaac. Chazarta va'amarta, and then subsequently you give me this instruction, ostensibly, kachna et bincha, to take him and to kill him. There's a contradiction. Now all of a sudden you come along and there's yet another contradiction. Achshav ata omerli, al tishlach yadcha el hana'ar. Did I ever tell you to harm him? Okay. So Abraham, as it were, is accusing God of inconsistency. And what's the Midrashic resolution? Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu. God says to Abraham, Lo achalel briti umotza sfatai lo ashane. I am incapable of inconsistency. So what's sticking out here? The first statement, B'Yitzchaki karei lecha zara, is sustained by the final comment of Al tishlach yadcha al hana'ar. They're not in contradiction. What is in contradiction to both of those statements is the middle one, namely, Halehu Sham Le'ola. So according to the Midrash, which as I said is cited by Rashi, what did God intend? Kshamarti lecha kach, motza sfotai lo ashane. You misunderstood me. Lo amarti lecha shchatehu. I never used the word slaughter him, make him a sacrifice. I said ha'alehu. And now what does God say in conclusion? Esakte, that's Aramaic for to raise up. So now that you've brought him up to the top of the mountain, what should you do? Achate, you're finished, you're done. You've carried out your orders, take him back home. I find this much more satisfying personally than the conventional interpretation, and I certainly find it a much healthier form of religious education than to take children sometimes as young as the third or fourth grade and to teach them that God may on one day tell their fathers to take them to the top of a mountain and take their lives. I'll finish with a little story. Nechama Leibovitz would ask a class in discussing the Akedah. Suppose one day you go out of your house early in the morning and you see your neighbor and he's got a backpack on, and on top of the backpack there is some kindling, and he's got this big machete strapped to his waist, and he's holding hands with his little son. And you say to him, hey, where are you going? You expect him to say, going on a camping trip. Instead tells him, well, you know, God came to me last night and he told me to take my son to the top of the mountain and to offer him as a sacrifice. Chamalevit said, what are you going to do? She says, I hope what you're going to do is run back home, call 911 and make sure that this fellow gets arrested and gets put away before he can do harm to anybody. Why should we think any differently of the story of the Akedah? And with that, I thank you all for your presence and for your participation. And I see that there isn't much here in the chat, but as much as there is, I will look at. Yes, yes, the famer eats shoots and leaves. Yes, a description of a panda, right? Pandas eat shoots and leaves, right? But as the title of a book, Eats, Shoots, and Leaves, it's not clear whether it's describing the diet of a panda or whether it's talking about somebody who had a meal and then took out a gun and shot everybody in the restaurant, as unfortunately happened not too long ago, as you know. Okay. Yeah, Alex X. Okay, I'm really not. I did not prepare the Septuagint on this. I'll take anybody's word for what the Septuagint did here. According to Jewish tradition, what is the greatest sacrifice a person can acceptably make to God? I'm not sure I know exactly what that means. I personally disapprove of the use of the word sacrifice for the translation of the word korban. Sacrifice, of course, comes from the root, the same root as the word sacred, whereas the word korban comes from the root that means to come near. A korban is something that enables you to come closer to God. So what you need to sacrifice to God is whatever it is that will make you feel closer to Him. It doesn't necessarily require the death of an animal. It certainly doesn't require the death of a human being. Korbanot could be made of meal offerings. Korbanot could be made of offerings of oil and wine. Those were also acceptable and poured as libations on the Mizbeach. They did not have to be animal sacrifices. It's an open question that we've discussed on Torah in Motion in related forums, whether the rebuilding of the temple, B'meirah v'yameinu, is going to be accompanied by the renewal of animal sacrifice or not. There are those like Rav Kook or certain interpreters of Rav Kook who maintained that, no, there will not be a renewal of animal sacrifice. There are others based upon a Rambam who maintain that there will be a renewal of animal sacrifice. I'm perfectly happy that if somebody actually manages to come, manages to gather in the remnants of Israel from all four corners of the world, defeat the forces of Amalek, and is proclaimed by the Sanhedrin of this time to be the Melech HaMashiach, whatever he says to do in the temple will be fine with me. Okay. I should just also note finally that the traditional image of the Akedah, in which if Abraham did not actually take Isaac's life, he at least attempted to, or even according to certain versions, he successfully took Isaac's life, forcing God to resurrect Isaac and then to stop Abraham from attempting it a second time, because there's a telltale verse that says, Vayikra elav malach Hashem shenit min hashamayim. All of those are no older than the year 1096. It would appear that the unfortunate circumstances of the First Crusade, in which European Jews in France and Germany and elsewhere were forced by circumstances to take their own lives and occasionally to take the lives of their wives and children as the alternative to forcible conversion, had a tremendous impact on the conventional understanding of the story of the Akedah. So much so that in 1948, you can find resonance, you can find traces of this, echoes of this, in early Israeli literature as well, where sacrifices that were made during the Milchemet HaShechur of 1948 were depicted in terms of Akedat Yitzchak. The definitive study on this subject is by Shalom Spiegel. It's called The Last Trial. And that's about really all I have to say about it, since I have exceeded my time.
It's okay. By the way, that's probably why in the Slichot, where you're alluding to at the end, is the Slichot that we say, and that's perhaps why people today are so into that notion. It's over and over again in Slichot, the willingness of Avraham to sacrifice his son, perhaps, like you say, influenced by the events of 1096, and you know, therefore got into our consciousness when these Slichot were all composed afterwards. So, thank you. Okay, right. I assume you agree with that comment. But
indeed.
Yes. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. We look forward to learning with you again in the near future. And I guess that's up to me and you, both of us. And tomorrow morning, my shiur, please go out 9:15 on the Siddur. Sunday, of course, Rabbi Liebtag, and of course, for those who remember, Benny Gesundheit began last week, a shiur in Tehillim in Hebrew. Monday, Matthew Nitzanim, young, making his debut on Torah Moshe, young upcoming scholar who's living in Israel, doing a degree in bioethics, will be starting a 6-part series. I think it's called What to Expect When You're Expecting. That's the name of the book, but it has to do with the beginning of life issues. So now Rabbi Brody is giving a series on the end of life issues. Now we'll go to the beginning of life issues. And that's going to be this Monday, beginning on Monday. He'll be in Israel, of course, giving the shiur Monday afternoon. And we look forward to learning with you, and I look forward to seeing you for good occasions. We should hear good news. And okay, thank you. Shabbat Shalom. And thank you again, Dr. Sokolow. And by the way, a couple of people were asking on the sources. We don't have the sources yet. I will.
Send them to Natalie.
Oh, just like right before. I'm sorry, haven't seen them yet. We will post them, and also, we have your article to post on the website. I'm sorry.
I don't know if it was posted, but I sent her both.
Okay, I think the article was posted. We'll post up the sources. Dr. Sokolow's article on how, in brackets, I think, not to teach the Akedah. And then the sources for this year. So that's why we didn't post it earlier. I'm sorry I didn't have it early enough, but we will. They will be on the website. Okay. Any other comments, questions, please?
I have a question. I was familiar with the Ralbag that you discussed so brilliantly, but I was taught, maybe mistakenly, that Ralbag implied that the lesson of the Akedah is to do something kivyachol. The Akedah was a kivyachol sacrifice, not a real, and it teaches us that performing a mitzvah kivyachol is good enough. Are you able to read that into Ralbag?
No, but I will tell you that in the published article, there is an appendix called An Unorthodox Reading of the Akedah that presents arguments to say that Rambam may very well have agreed with the proposition that the entire Akedah transpired only in a prophetic vision. So if a prophetic vision meets your definition of kiviyachol, then yes, there is a way to do it.
Via interpretations of Rambam, you're saying?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. The Rambam, of course, also said the three angels coming to visit Avram at the beginning of the parsha is also just in a dream. And the Ramban gets, of course, very upset when the Rambam says things like that. And Yaakov's fight with the angel was also a prophetic vision. But okay, that's the Rambam, who was not afraid to voice controversial opinions. Let's just put it that way. But yeah, but I, by the way, I did not know that the Rambam also said that by the Akedah. I know in the other places.
No. He if he had said it explicitly, right, it wouldn't require an article and three arguments. The argument is based on those places in the Moreh in which he describes the kinds of things that could, for example, when the prophet Yirmiyahu is told to go about naked. The prophet Yechezkel is told to eat a Megillah. Rambam says that any time in which a prophet is told to do something that is either illegal or unseemly, then it has to be understood as part only of a prophetic vision. Therefore, if indeed the argument would be that if indeed it is prohibited to offer a child sacrifice, and if God seems to have told him to do it, then it could only have been meant in, to be done in a prophetic vision.
Unless you want to argue,
the material is there in the article.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Lila Tov, anybody else? And we'll, please God, we'll see you soon.
I have a question that just came. I'm going for it. I was thinking of Sodom and how Abraham, you know, he wasn't backing down and he challenged God. It's the same God that spoke to him. Why couldn't he have that discussion with God before he left, like at some point? Why couldn't he?
You mean about Isaac?
Yeah.
So as I said, because until the very last moment, that's not what he thought he was supposed to do. In fact, if you want, in the article, I think I formulated it as follows, that the lesson, the moral lesson is, if Abraham had somehow felt in some circumstance that it was incumbent upon him to take his own life, right? Mm-hmm. What we call a yehareg va'al ya'avor, then we would applaud him for it. Mm-hmm. But what the lesson of the Akedah is not to make our children the victims of our poor parshanut.
Yeah, and it also buttresses this opinion, yes, that is why he didn't.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
If I may, half a minute, I know it's late, but obviously this is not a common interpretation you're going to hear anywhere else. I don't know if you just, and which is fine. That's no problem.
I have heard something like this because a lot of people discuss it at length, not being able to wrap their heads around it. But
the classic interpretation that, you know, God
commanded
him, and that's, I'm just, you know, it's just kind of interesting how you, in the yeshiva setting, you're not going to hear this type of, whatever. I mean, it's not the way, that's for sure not how Rav Soloveitchik understood the story. Hmm. You know, with the Kierkegaardian approach, you know, of Rav Soloveitchik. But whatever. I don't know if you want to comment on that, Dr. Sokolow, at all. Or you don't have to.
It's fine. I don't mind the epithet uncommon.
Yeah, no, it's fine. I'm just, you know, okay.
Or even okay. Unorthodox.
Yeah. Okay. No problem. Just,
I have a question too, if I can. The regular interpretation of Hashem commanding, and however Avraham understood it, he also understood that Hashem had told him that Yitzchak would be his successor. So he was willing to do whatever God told him because somehow he knew that everything would be okay. So why is the emphasis on the Akedah rather than on Avraham's kindness to strangers, other things that he did, rather than the Akedah, for those that believe that, you know, the traditional interpretation?
I'm not sure I understand your question. If you want to try again, please.
Sure. Abraham knew that if Hashem said Yitzchak was going to...
Okay. Now I realize what you're saying. Okay. That was the last source that I cited that in the Rashi, right? That Abraham said to God, wait, let's talk this out. You did in fact tell me that Isaac will be my, continue my dynasty, right? But then you came along and told me to kill him. So ostensibly, your second instruction to me, your more recent words to me, contradict and nullify your earlier words. So when I'm at the moment, I'm not working under Biyitzchak Yikare Lechazara. At the moment, what I'm working under is Haleu Sham La'ola.
Correct. But the way that many of us were taught was that Abraham did it willingly and there was no discussion. And if you understand it that way, then what's the explanation for why the emphasis on that, if Abraham knew that somehow, whether it was reincarnated, whatever it would, that somehow he would...
As I said, the only thing that occurs to me is that, again, that on the influence of the Crusades and the like, Abraham and Isaac simply became paradigmatic figures of martyrdom. And therefore, since martyrdom, listen, we refer to the 6 million as martyrs, right? We call them kedoshim. Okay, so the notion of martyrdom is so much part of a fabric of the Jewish, you know, national consciousness that it was simply just a natural thing for people to see the story of Abraham and Isaac as being an instance, a display of martyrdom. Therefore, the assumption was from the outset, that's what happens. That's how you make martyrs. Martyrs are people who die because God somehow, is pleased with the sacrifices, the personal sacrifices that they make on his behalf.
It just bothers me that the emphasis is still on that rather than all the other positive attributes.
No, I don't know what you mean. The emphasis is not on the others. Of course, the emphasis on others is when God, in this week's parasha, why does God reveal to Abraham his plans for Sodom?
So that he can do something about it.
Exactly. So he does take note of it. He does take note of it. It's a very important part of Abraham's personality. Not just his willingness to make a sacrifice on the part of God, but his willingness also to go to bat, as it were, for even strangers. So I wouldn't say that it's, you know, that it's not emphasized.
Okay.
I'm not sure he knew for sure. Like, I think your presumption that Avram knew was going to turn out okay, which is, I think, what you're saying, because God promised him, you know, Yitzchak, he'll be a great nation to Yitzchak. That's what made it so difficult for Avram. In other words, this is a reversal of that promise. Like, you're assuming he knew that promise would be true. I don't know. Maybe he thought that promise got, you know, canceled with the Akedah. That's what troubled him. I'm not sure the premise of the question is correct. If I think
that many of us teach is that was his faith, that of course everything would. That's what was so honorable.
I don't know. No, that's why he was so hard, because God just promised him, and he waited so long to have a kid, and then God tells him to kill the kid. What happened to that promise? In other words, that's the problem he's dealing with. I don't know that Avram had a solution to that problem. I don't think ever, it's all going to work out okay. No, I don't know. He thought that's it. That's the end of the promise. And I don't know what's going to be.
I mean, I agree with that, but that's not the way we were taught.
Okay. There are many ways to teach. So we often, you know, but yeah, okay. Okay. I don't know. I don't know that that everybody teaches that. I'm not sure. I can't comment to. Okay. Dr. Sokolow, we'll let you go. Have a good Shabbos, and everybody be well. And we look forward to learning with everybody soon. Okay, have a good night, everybody. Thank you.